as did the Archbishop of Canterbury, Geoffrey Fisher, who sat on the platform and pronounced the benediction. The Archbishop's coolness toward the crusade had been obvious since the outset, and this was the first service he bothered to attend. Even then, some felt his implicit endorsement was not all it might have been. Bishop A.W. Goodwin Hudson, one of Graham's champions in the Anglican hierarchy, recalled that the Archbishop took out a piece of paper, fidgeted with it, and then read his benediction. "He must have done it a million times before. He did not declare himself. It was perfunctory. It could have been better." The Archbishop, however, may have been overwhelmed, not diffident. When the service ended, he turned to Grady Wilson and said with a bit of wistful wonder in his voice, "I don't think we'll ever see a sight like this again until we get to heaven." The southern plumber's son, never one to stand on ceremony, and perhaps unaware that the customary form of direct address was "Your Grace," threw a beefy arm around the prelate, gave him a good squeeze, and said, "That's right, Brother Archbishop, that's right." His Grace was not the only clergyman to manifest a change of heart. Less than 2 weeks after the crusade started, the Church of England asked for a special series of training classes to equip its members to participate in the counseling and follow-up aspects of the crusade. The Reverend Frank Martin, writing in the Sunday Graphic, proclaimed after his first exposure to the evangelist's preaching that "this Billy Graham line just won't do. Just pelting us with texts will never convert British sinners. The whole thing is, and I say it in all charity, too spiritually bouncy and immature." 11 weeks later, at the close of the crusade, Martin wrote, "Thank you, Billy. You've done us a power of good. Come again soon." Donald Soper, president of the Methodist Conference and known for his ardent defense of various social welfare causes, refused to budge from his charge that there is not a single reputable theologian in the churches who agrees with what is promulgated at Haringey. But his equally respected colleague, Leslie Weatherhead, then president-designate of the Methodist Conference, asked, "And what does fundamentalist theology matter, compared with gathering in the people we've all missed and getting them to the point of decision? Theology comes later." Once again, as had been the case throughout the history of evangelistic preaching, criticisms of substance and method had to move to the side to make room for the converts who were crowding the aisles. Graham's ability to win the support of his clerical critics turned in no small measure on his consistent manifestation of humility in the face of criticism. Colleen Townsend Evans, who had abandoned her movie career for Christian service and had come to London to assist with the crusade, recalled being in a small group as a team member read an article in which a London clergyman had absolutely blasted the evangelist. He listened very thoughtfully and carefully, and finally, when he had heard the whole tirade, he lifted his head and looked at all of us and said very thoughtfully, "Well, I guess if I'd been in that man's place, I might have thought the same thing about me." Whether present on that occasion or not, the often critical Christian Century found evidence of the same spirit. "Billy Graham," the magazine observed, "is revealing himself as extraordinarily teachable and humble, considering that he is surrounded with the fevered adulation of crowds so much of the time. He will learn a great deal in London, and will, if he keeps up the growth which has characterized his last 3 years, put what he learns to good use for Christ and the Church." The secular press also experienced a conversion of sorts. With the exception of Hannon Swaffer, whose disdain continued unabated, Graham's open friendliness, transparent sincerity, and disarming humility transformed acid into warm milk. Daily Express columnist William Hickey admitted he was inclined to be rude to Graham at an interview, but he wrote, "That is where the personality of the man comes into the picture. He is not a man you can be rude to, for the simple reason that a voice inside you tells you that this is a man of integrity." While admitting he might be wrong, Hickey said, "I think he is a good man. I'm not so sure that he isn't a saintly man. I just don't know. But make no mistake about this. Billy Graham is a remarkable man. He's an American. He hasn't the inhibitions we suffer from. Perhaps he is what Britain needs. It is a bitter pill to swallow. As if this were not sufficient, at the end of the interview, when Hickey shook Graham's hand, he has the firm, self-conscious grip of the American executive, wished the evangelist Godspeed, and left his presence. He was stunned to realize that my eyes were scalding with tears. William Connor, writing in the Daily Mirror under the pen name Cassandra, did a similar turnabout. After suffering two acerbic attacks, Graham wrote a short note asking Connor for the opportunity to meet him. "While your articles about me were not entirely sympathetic," he graciously observed, "they were two of the most cleverly written that I have ever read." In a nice bit of irony, Cassandra suggested they meet at a pub called Baptist Head. After their meeting, at which Connor had a beer and Graham a soft drink, the columnist described Graham as having a kind of ferocious cordiality that scares ordinary sinners stone cold, and confessed to an urge to set about some devilment as soon as he switched on his looming, bulging goodness of heart. But it would not work. "I never thought that friendliness had such a sharp, cutting edge," he marveled. "I never thought that simplicity could cudgel a sinner so damned hard. We live and we learn. The bloke means everything he says." The massive crowds and widespread acclaim were so dramatic that they helped Graham gain one of the most treasured moments of the campaign, a meeting with Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Graham had, of course, invited Churchill to the crusade and had sought to arrange a personal meeting with the great man through one of his private secretaries, but Churchill declined both requests. The Wembley rally, however, piqued his curiosity, and he agreed to receive the evangelist for a courtesy visit of 5 minutes, probably calculating that he and his party could not be hurt by a nod of recognition to the man who had so captured the nation's attention. Precisely at noon on the second day after the Wembley service, Billy Frank Graham of Charlotte, North Carolina, was ushered into the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street to meet the most formidable figure of the mid-20th century. Ironically, Churchill may have been more anxious than Graham. Before Billy arrived, he paced back and forth, wondering aloud what one talked about with an American evangelist. When Billy entered the room, whose dim light suggested dusk rather than midday, he found the Prime Minister standing at the center of a long conference table, fingering one of his famous cigars, still unlit. He was surprised to discover that his host was such a short man, but still felt awed in his presence. Churchill seemed depressed. Several times he said, "I'm an old man, without any hope for the world." Then he asked Graham, "What hope do you have for the world, young man?" Whether by design or accident, the Prime Minister had hit upon the perfect topic to discuss with an American evangelist. Billy reached into his pocket, withdrew his little New Testament, and earnestly burbled, "Mr. Prime Minister, I am filled with hope." Gesturing with his testament, he said, "Life is very exciting, even if there's a war, because I know what is going to happen in the future." He then proceeded to give Churchill a recitation of the significance of the life, death, and resurrection of Christ, and professed his strong belief that Christ would come again to bring human history to a glorious conclusion. Churchill said little, but he listened closely as the visit stretched to 40 minutes. He told Graham that perhaps the only hope for humanity was, indeed, a return to God, and he asked that the details of their conversation remain private. His aides later indicated that he had been impressed with the earnest young American. Certainly Graham had been impressed with him. "I felt," he said, "like I had shaken hands with Mr. History." Sinners, critics, and skeptics were not the only ones who changed. At the suggestion of advisors, Billy reduced both the speed and volume of his delivery, further reined in his tendency to pace about the stage and dramatize his stories, and even disowned some of his most egregious literalisms. Of his 1950 description of heaven as a 1,600-mile cube, for example, he said, "It is a statement I do not make any longer, something I no longer hold, but there seems to be no way I can live it down." It was sufficient, he thought, to know that to live with God is called heaven. As for hell, he told reporters, that "I do believe in hell, I believe there is a hell on earth for those who break the moral laws of God, and I believe there is a hell to come. But whether there is fire there, I do not know. In keeping with this progressive move toward decorum and respectability, Cliff Barrows retired his trombone, and when reporters suggested that people responded to the invitation because of the almost hypnotic effect of the music, he stopped using an invitation hymn for a time, with no effect on the response. Graham also moderated some of his political views. Not long after arriving in London, he conceded that you can say what you like about socialism, but it's done a lot of good here. More substantially, he repeatedly touted the labor union movement as one of the proudest legacies of Wesley's and Moody's revivals. And he urged the churches to show as much concern for unions as for other economic groups. At the same time, those who viewed him as a crass American entrepreneur who used professional revival techniques to extract money from the gullible could not but fall silent when they learned that BGEA was picking up over half the £150,000 cost of the crusade, and that Graham had permitted the sponsoring committee to stop taking collections at services long before the crusade ended, even though this increased the burden on his organization. The critical test of an evangelistic crusade, of course, is not the amount or quality of press coverage, nor the number of famous people met and favorably impressed, but the lasting impact on individuals and institutions. Some results were easy to quantify. When relay services and meetings held by associate evangelists were added to those at which Graham preached, the total attendance for the 12-week crusade topped 2 million. Of that number, 36,431 filled out decision cards and received counseling. According to BGEA figures, 90% of those reported some kind of church connection, but 75% regarded themselves as making a first-time decision, suggesting the connection was quite nominal. Approximately half of all inquirers described themselves as essentially unchurched. Enthusiastic British evangelicals almost uniformly credited the crusade with producing the greatest wave of religious interest since the onset of World War I. And some boldly compared it to Wesley's efforts, which had led to the founding of the Methodist Church. Those who regarded its results more modestly took pleasure in seeing religion, particularly evangelical religion, become front-page news and a topic of general conversation. Even the venerable London Sunday Times noted that the churches had been astonished to discover that the spirit of materialism they believed had caused people to lose interest in spiritual matters had been exposed as no more than a veneer covering a widespread and genuine religious longing. Eventually, of course, church leaders and journalists and sociologists began to look at the results more closely and critically, as would prove to be the case throughout Graham's ministry. The spectacles through which the investigators examined the data tended to affect their methods and their findings. 7 months after the crusade ended, a London Evening Standard poll of the city's 20 largest Anglican parishes found that over two-thirds of the 336 inquirers referred to them were already members or regular attenders of the churches that received their cards. Of the remaining 110 people, only 35 were still attending church. If these proportions held good for other congregations, the net gain in new members for all of Great Britain's churches would be 4,000 people, a mere 11% of all inquirers. Evangelicals responded by noting that limiting the survey to Anglican churches could skew the results, since the most vigorous supporters of the crusade had been non-Anglican evangelical bodies. The British Weekly, a non-denominational Christian paper that had backed the crusade, eventually conceded that the main impact was among already sympathetic church members. The effect outside the church, speaking generally, appears to have been very little indeed in terms of figures. The Archbishop of Canterbury expressed a similar sense of mild disillusionment. Immediately after the crusade, he wrote a quite positive assessment of Graham's work for the Canterbury Diocesan Notes. 3 years later, he reluctantly concluded that there is very little to show for the Haringey Crusade. Graham's supporters typically defended the crusade with anecdotes rather than with statistics. Telling of churches directly across the street from each other, one of which had supported the crusade wholeheartedly, while the other remained disdainful and aloof, with the result that the standoffish church got no new members, and the active church soon had to add new services to accommodate a swarm of converts. The lesson seemed clear. Churches got from a crusade what they put into it, but not every case supported this analysis. Some active churches gained few or no new members, but many pastors reported that even with little tangible growth, they saw increased vitality in their congregations and indicated they would welcome another Billy Graham crusade. Perhaps the most significant tangible impact of the Haringey Crusade was its role in persuading an unusually large number of young men to enter the ministry, and to do so with explicitly evangelical beliefs and motives. Before the Crusade, only 7% of Anglican seminarians and ordinands identified themselves as evangelicals. The rest tended to be theological liberals, with little or no interest in evangelism. In 1956, 23 of 33 men ordained in the various Anglican dioceses of London were evangelicals. A year later, the proportion was 22 of 32. Other dioceses and other denominations reported similar figures. From that time until the present, according to knowledgeable Anglican churchmen, evangelical theological schools have consistently enrolled far more students than their liberal counterparts, and numerous key British church leaders, Anglicans and non-Anglicans alike, trace either their conversion or their decision to enter the ministry to the Haringey Crusade. No individual experienced a greater impact from the crusade than Billy Graham himself. However one might assess the effects of his preaching on others, Haringey gave his own career an incalculable boost. By touching London, he touched the entire British Empire, whose tentacles reached around the globe. By leaving his mark on this great world capital, he transformed himself into a world figure. Both the American ambassador and the British Home Secretary credited him with doing more for Anglo-American relations than any man or diplomatic effort had been able to achieve since the end of the war. In reporting that bit of intelligence to President Eisenhower, he offered an observation that might well have expressed his feelings about the accolades and generous assessments tossed his way in Haringey's aftermath. This may be an exaggeration, but if these meetings have helped, I'm deeply grateful. Chapter 12. Fields White Into Harvest. In the years following the triumph at Haringey, Graham did his best to fulfill Jesus' directive to preach the gospel to the whole creation. Mark chapter 16, verse 15. Or at least enough of it to satisfy his 1954 aspiration to be a true world evangelist. Though he held only 8 full-scale crusades in the United States between Haringey and the end of the decade, he kept busy spreading his message from Berlin to New Delhi to Tokyo. As a result of his worldwide successes, he advanced from being the popular young favorite of evangelical Christianity's key leaders to occupying a position of unchallenged prominence in their front rank. Immediately following Haringey, Billy and small bands of associates set out on a whirlwind tour of European cities. Bob Evans had planned a series of modest rallies, but the news from Haringey stimulated such interest that most of these were transferred to the largest stadium in each city. The overflow crowds clearly justified the change. In Stockholm, 65,000 thronged Skansen Arena for the largest religious meeting ever held in Sweden. In Copenhagen, 15,000 stood outdoors in a pouring rain to hear Billy speak in the city square. In Amsterdam, he preached to 40,000, but it was in Germany that he experienced both the heaviest criticism and greatest success. Repeatedly, he came under fire for what his critics saw as a uniquely American blend of commercialism and sensationalism. They characterized him as a Hollywood version of John the Baptist and a salesman in God's company, who advertises the Bible as if it were toothpaste or chewing gum, and is overly concerned with the size of the commission. Critics also scored him for a theology they judged to be superficial and naively literalistic, citing such statements as from birth to grave, God has a TV camera focused on you, and every bad word is being taped. His proclamation that people could be born again simply by professing their belief in Christ ran counter to the time-honored process of catechism and confirmation practiced in the Reformed, Lutheran, and Calvinist traditions, and to some seemed tantamount to heresy. To step forward at Billy Graham's invitation, as a sign they were accepting Christ as their Savior, seemed to call into question the validity of the entire confirmation process, and thus of the theology the ministers held dear. Both the individualism and pluralism implicit in revivalist preaching, decisions are personal and differences in belief and practice are downplayed, contrasted sharply with a more hierarchical and communal ethos of the European parish, creating another source of discomfort. The sharpest attacks, however, came from the East German press, which charged him with being a spy, a tool of Texas oilmen, a front man for weapons manufacturers, a reference to Alfred Owens, an envoy of American imperialism and capitalism, and a demagogue who used the same techniques employed by Hitler. One paper published a cartoon that showed him flying over Berlin with a Bible in one hand and an atom bomb in the other, while Secretary Dulles cheered in the background. Several papers cited his address to American military personnel at Frankfurt, in which he had praised West Germany's post-war recovery and observed that to deter Soviet aggression, the country should be equipped with the most modern and effective weapons available. A statement that also stirred a furor in London, which viewed any encouragement of German rearmament with deep suspicion. In what would become a familiar tactic, Graham denied he had any political agenda, insisting that the opinion he had expressed was not his own, but simply an observation he had heard others make. In light of later controversial statements, it seemed like he was expressing a political opinion he felt would please his immediate audience, without adequate consideration of its probable reception in other quarters. But whatever the accuracy of the charges leveled against him, they did little to dampen enthusiasm for his mission. The emotional and statistical high point of the German tour occurred in Berlin. The rally was scheduled for the great Olympic Stadium, where Hitler and Goebbels had goaded a nation into war, and Graham had learned that large numbers of East Germans would be present. The Berlin Wall had not yet been erected. The symbolic aspects of proclaiming the crucified Christ in what had been a shrine of the twisted cross of Nazism did not escape Billy. A few hours before the rally, he lay writhing in agony in his hotel room, suffering from a kidney stone, but refusing to take strong painkillers because they would make him too dopey to preach. Wrestling anew with the forces of ambition and humility that warred within him, he speculated to a friend that perhaps God had sent this affliction to remind him that he should not allow the recent triumph at Herengay or the huge crowds he was attracting in Europe to cause him to believe he could depend on his own strength or rhetorical power, since that would be to repeat the tragic hubris Hitler had displayed in the same stadium where he would speak that very afternoon. His friend could understand that fear better than most. John Bolton had been a confidant of Hitler's during the early years of his rise to power. When Hitler began to unleash his maniacal hatred of Jews, a group of industrialists persuaded Bolton to convey their objections to this policy. And Hitler reacted with such rage that Bolton fled to America, settling in Boston, and gradually building a new fortune to replace the one he had left behind in his homeland. He had rededicated his life to Christ during Graham's 1950 Boston campaign, and had become one of the evangelist's key supporters. Now back in his native country to help smooth Graham's way, he pondered the irony of riding in a motorcade along the same route Hitler had taken to the same stadium less than two decades earlier, in the company of a young Timothy with a very different message, but nonetheless a charismatic orator whose ability to sway masses of people was propelling him to heights of power. Inside the stadium, 80,000 people, at least 20,000 from East Germany, sang Protestant hymns where Nazi war anthems had once been raised. And the banner that hung in the swastika's place proclaimed Jesus' assertion, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." The tremendous turnout and the strong response to the invitation, stadium officials would not permit people to come forward out of the stands, but thousands filled out cards asking for an opportunity to discuss the Christian faith, was a victory for Graham and his message. Having failed at keeping people away from the rally, the communist press tried to discredit Graham by reporting that he had taken his team to East German nightclubs, where he had ordered liquor by the case and then been thrown into jail for trying to sneak out without paying the bill. But the story received no more credibility than it deserved. In 1955, Graham returned to both the United Kingdom and the continent. His tour of the UK included a six-week stand in Glasgow's Kelvin Hall, as well as a week-long stint in Wembley Stadium in London, and was by any normal standard of measurement a success. A Good Friday service, for example, was broadcast from Kelvin Hall by both BBC radio and television, the first time any preacher used the combined networks for a religious program, and reached a larger audience than any program in the history of British television, save for the Queen's coronation. Yet some of the bloom had faded from the evangelical rose since Graham told U.S. News and World Report shortly after Haringey that Great Britain was at the beginning of what could be the greatest spiritual awakening of all times. Despite record crowds, the public impact of this second tour simply did not compare with the first. Several factors contributed to the lessened enthusiasm, including disillusion among Church of England clergy about the long-term results of Graham's approach, as well as the simple fact that Billy Graham was now old news. Nevertheless, Graham did see thousands respond to the invitation, and no doubt took personal pleasure from his association with the highest social stratum in Anglo-American society, the royal family. Queen Elizabeth and several members of the family had viewed the Good Friday broadcast from Kelvin Hall, and it was rumored that Princess Margaret had attended at least one service at Wembley. Whether true or not, she and the Queen Mother did entertain Billy and Ruth at Clarence House. And on the Sunday following the crusade, Graham preached to the Queen and other members of the family in the Royal Chapel at Windsor Great Park. This was the first time an American preacher had been accorded this honor. After the Wembley Crusade, Graham made another whistle-stop tour of 12 European cities, where he experienced what was becoming the standard response, opposition, or foot-dragging resistance from established clergy claiming his message and methods were unsound and too unsophisticated to appeal to Europeans and stadium-packing crowds who seemed not to have realized they were above this sort of thing. The longest of these ventures was a four-day effort in Paris, the first time Protestants had mounted a major evangelistic effort in modern France's history. Reminiscent of the flap over the socialism calendar in England, Graham stirred a small controversy by declaring at a press conference that France is like a watch without its mainspring. It has run down. The French just sin and get weaker. Americans accustomed to being damned by preachers may have taken such an assessment in stride, especially when coming from one of their own. Self-assured Frenchmen were less willing to be so harshly judged when called to account for his unflattering assessment. Graham resorted to an increasingly familiar ploy. He claimed these were not necessarily his own feelings, but that he had been quoting the remarks of a Far Eastern diplomat, that he regretted very much that anyone had misconstrued his statement, and that he wished the papers had quoted the many wonderful things he had said about France at the same press conference. In any case, the damage was minor. Crowds were surprisingly good for a country that was largely either Roman Catholic or openly secular, and the prestigious newspaper Le Monde counseled Parisians not to mock the American style of such a religious manifestation, but to bow before Graham's spiritual dynamism. His technique may offend European intellectuals, but the fact remains he is successful. French Protestants who, despite some reservations, did not hesitate to ask him to come to our country made no mistake. Later that same year, Graham returned to England to conduct a brief mission at Cambridge University. The customary resistance to his message in such settings was increased by the fact that he came at the invitation of the Cambridge Intercollegiate Christian Union, CICCU, pronounced KICU, an aggressively evangelical organization noted for its buttonholing tactics and lack of cooperation with other Christian groups. Most of the college chaplains and theology professors expressed open skepticism or outright opposition to the fundamentalism they believed he represented. And an exchange in the London Times made the visit and the nature of fundamentalism itself a matter of some national debate, particularly in religious circles. Graham, ever insecure about his lack of advanced theological education, dreaded the meetings and feared that a poor showing might do serious harm to his ministry and affect which way the tide will turn in Britain. Had he been able to do so without a complete loss of face, he would have canceled the meetings or persuaded some better qualified man to replace him. "I am scared stiff about preaching at Cambridge," he told Stephen Alford, who counseled him not to get involved in a philosophical approach or to try to do something that was out of his depth, lest he be discredited for inaccuracies, and remember that he was preaching not to students, but to sinners, and should keep things simple. Graham found Alford's advice hard to accept. In the first two or three meetings, he tried to be at least somewhat intellectual, but found his sermons falling flat. Finally, midway through the series, he abandoned the effort and addressed them as if they had gathered at Haringey or Kelvin Hall, not the hallowed university church. Neither approach got high marks from the Cambridge dons who bothered to attend the services, but he did generate an enthusiasm among students that some compared to D.L. Moody's historic visit in 1882. At one address, a divinity professor who introduced him pointedly noted that he could not agree with his doctrinal views. Graham countered this chill-inducing remark with a warm smile and observed that he did not pay great attention to theological differences. "We are all Christians," he said, "and we love one another." With that as a basic foundation, soul-winning is more important than hair-splitting. "A minister is not a minister," he asserted, "unless he is winning men for Christ. If theological students don't think they can do that, they should quit studying for the ministry." The students, many of whom were preparing to be ministers, applauded him for a full 3 minutes. With repeated successes in Great Britain and on the continent under his belt, Graham decided to challenge the Far East. During the 1955 Wembley Crusade, he met with Jack Dane, an Anglican who spent many years as a missionary to India and was intimately familiar with the religious situation in that country, and asked him to help set up a month-long tour. Dane quickly sketched a map of India on a breakfast napkin, scribbling in the cities they should visit and the route they should follow. With his typical trust in the expertise of his advisors, Graham accepted Dane's recommendations completely and asked him to take charge of the campaign. Dane had seen what Graham had wrought in London and Scotland, and the prospect of similar triumphs in his adopted homeland excited him mightily, but his faith was not boundless. "The Christian church is such a small minority in India," he noted. "We have never considered ever anything like a citywide evangelistic crusade." Those of us who knew Billy knew what God was doing with him, but I think I've got to be honest and say that we had our doubts as to whether this could happen in India. But when Dane spread the word that Graham was willing to come, invitations from his many contacts in India poured in, so that the tour, while technically at the invitation of Indian Christians, was able to follow the exact route he had sketched on the napkin. Graham faced the trip with his usual mixture of trepidation and boldness, fearing he could fail miserably, yet believing the tour might mark a turning point in the history of Indian Christianity. He carried with him the good wishes of church and state alike. Harold John Akinge, still the dominant figure of evangelical Christianity, reminded him of God's words to young Joshua when he assumed the leadership of Israel. "As I was with Moses, so will I be with thee. President Eisenhower sent him an encouraging telegram shortly before he departed, and John Foster Dulles, whose enthusiasm for Graham apparently matched Eisenhower's, invited him to his home for an hour-long briefing on world affairs. Dulles, a minister's son, who had often sounded the need for a righteous and dynamic faith to counteract the quasi-religious zeal of dedicated communists, commended him for not watering down his message in foreign lands, but also gave him a bit of political advice, perhaps hoping Graham would not make statements that ran counter to U.S. foreign policy. The secretary referred to the evangelist's recent recommendations that American farm surpluses be sent immediately to needy peoples, pointing out that such a policy would have negative effects on the agricultural economy of such nations as Australia and Argentina. He also brought him up to date on the relationship between the United States and India, which were experiencing some tension over Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru's attempt to carve out for his young democracy a then unheard-of position as a non-aligned nation. The Eisenhower administration did not believe such a position was tenable, and many suspected Nehru of using this approach as a rather transparent front for a tilt toward Russia. A recent visit of Soviet leaders Khrushchev and Bulganin had drawn large and enthusiastic crowds. Dulles thought it crucial to bring India into the U.S. camp to prevent other nations from adopting a similar non-aligned stance, and seemed to think Graham might be an effective advocate for U.S. interests. According to Graham, the secretary told him that one of India's greatest needs was for someone like him to proclaim the Christian message of discipline and authority to its masses, particularly at this time, when the favorable memory of the Russian leaders was still fresh. Graham apparently saw no conflict between the roles of soul-saver and semi-official representative of American foreign policy. Whatever was bad for communism and good for capitalism must obviously be a plus for Christianity. Thus prepared, Graham set sail for India. When he arrived, the country obviously astonished and enchanted him, its exotic nature gratifying his lifelong desire to visit strange lands and stimulating the curiosity about other cultures that his anthropological studies at Wheaton had encouraged. At times, he was simply overwhelmed by the magnitude of the Indian population and its problems. He tried to keep a vow, made back at Florida Bible Institute, to sign autographs for anyone who asked him. But crowds he could never have imagined as he roamed the streets of Temple Terrace made it impossible. The poverty he saw on every hand tugged at his compassion. "Beggars were all around in Bombay," he wrote to Ruth, who had stayed behind in Montreat. "Some men with their legs gone, others with their arms that had been eaten by disease, and blind men everywhere, all asking for money. It was one of the most heartbreaking scenes that I had seen since I left Korea. I wanted to give every one of them the message of Christ and give them all money." Ignoring the warnings of missionary friends, he did give some of the money, distributing as many rupees as I possibly could to as many people as I saw in need, until he found himself engulfed by a teeming whirlpool of beggars screaming and fighting for more, forcing him to concede that his advisors were right. He could not, by himself, alleviate poverty in India. At first, the campaign itself seemed in danger of being overwhelmed by the tumultuous country, as Graham arrived in the midst of wild riots and turmoil caused by the government's redivision of Indian states. An American reporter, whose dispatches from the tour would become a laudatory book later in the year, dismissed the upheaval with the observation that authorities agreed that the riots were inspired by communists who brought in goon squads, and noted that a young man who was asked why he was throwing stones had answered, "I don't know, somebody told me to." Whatever the degree of communist involvement, the riots clearly had nothing to do with Graham, and he felt remarkably unthreatened by them. "All people will respond to a smile and affection," he later observed. "In Bombay, rioters were throwing rocks at each other, but as I passed, I smiled, and they smiled back." He could not, it seemed, conceive of the possibility that a riot might be an expression of justifiable discontent and anger, rather than the work of evil conspirators. Nor could he move beyond his conviction that all problems and their solutions are ultimately individualistic. However deep-seated it may or may not have been, the turmoil was sufficient to compel cancellation of a large stadium rally slated for Bombay. Several small indoor services and a large meeting with ministers went on as scheduled, and Graham received wide public exposure through a press conference at which he spent most of his time explaining the basics of evangelical Christian belief, rather than answering the questions about American political issues he had expected to receive. As Graham and his small band of associates moved southward, the tour finally assumed its hoped-for contours, including crowds far larger than anyone had publicly predicted. In many respects, the rallies and crusades during this portion of the tour resembled those in America and Europe, a circumstance aided by the fact that most were scheduled in the Indian Bible Belt, where the majority of the nation's Christians were concentrated and could be counted on to generate a good turnout for the meetings. In each city, the sponsoring committee followed standard operating procedures and launched a publicity barrage that included advertising sheets nailed to trees and loudspeaker trucks that rumbled through cities and villages, inviting people to hear the dynamic young Christian from America. Wherever he went, Billy preached the same things he had preached from the swamps of Florida to the venerable halls of Cambridge University: Belshazzar's Feast, John chapter 3, verse 16, and the Second Coming. In Madras, attendance over 3 days exceeded 100,000, with 4,000 to 5,000 inquirers. A response that swamped the counseling corps and moved Billy to marvel that all you could hear was just the tramp, tramp, tramp of bare feet and sandaled feet as they were coming forward quietly and reverently. This was God. Yes, the same God that was with us at Wembley and Haringey and Kelvin Hall has been with us here in India. His basic crusade, Graham learned in a lesson that would be crucial to his career, could be packaged and delivered with amazingly little alteration to a land whose history and culture could hardly differ more strikingly from those of North Carolina, particularly if he restricted himself primarily to areas already familiar with the Christian message. But despite this apparent success, even Graham admitted that the enormous crowds resulted in part from the novelty of his being an American, and it seemed clear that some non-Christian observers were baffled by what they heard and saw. One Indian reporter marveled at the strangeness of his message. Graham, he wrote, propounds the theory that the reproductive act, for instance, is in itself sinful, the whole business being a legacy from Adam and Eve. He insisted that his son, age 3, was a liar, and asserted that he himself had wallowed in evil pleasures until, at the age of 17, a voice had asked him to spread the divine message. The reporter acknowledged, however, that these peculiarities notwithstanding, Dr. Graham can be dreadfully effective. The high point of the crusade as a whole, however, came at Kadiyan, a city of only 50,000 located in the heart of India's largest Christian population. Aware that no existing setting would accommodate the anticipated throngs, local church leaders commissioned the construction of a massive temporary amphitheater around the athletic field of a school belonging to the Church of South India. Using small hand tools and baskets, a corps of young girls labored for hours, carving terraces into a hillside to provide seating areas for worshipers, segregated by sex as was customary, with women sitting at levels lower than those occupied by men. Graham's host in Kadiyam was Bishop Jacob, spiritual leader of the Church of South India and vice president of the World Council of Churches. Upon the evangelist's arrival, the bishop told him, with a straight face, but perhaps with an inner smile, that just a week earlier, snake charmers had captured 26 cobras in the front yard. He assured him, however, that very rarely do the cobra come in the house, and that even though people were bitten every day, many of them survive. Given this bit of intelligence, Graham may not have slept well that night under any circumstances, but when a strange communal buzz awakened him at 4 a.m., he looked out a window in his room to see an amazing sight. 5,000 worshipers had already assembled and were conducting a massive prayer service, entreating God to bless the American evangelist's visit to their country. This was only the beginning. Throughout the following day, Billy and his team watched in wonder as little knots of pilgrims, all dressed in white and many with large Bibles under their arms, drifted in from every direction and found places sitting on palm leaves to protect themselves from the ground's slight chill. More than half had traveled at least 10 miles. Some had walked 50 or 60 miles. All day they continued to arrive, filling the amphitheater until the crowd had grown to an astounding 75,000 by the time Graham spoke that evening, their garments gleaming in the glare of the powerful arc lights, a dazzling company of Christians larger than any the region had ever seen. Though most were Christians and almost worshipful in their attitude toward him, Graham admitted to some anxiety. "When I leave the platform at night," he wrote to Ruth, "the bishop always takes me through the milling crowd. It's, in a sense, a terrifying experience with the crowd pressing in close with their dark faces peering at you, trying to get us in view, and you could imagine that anything could happen if they became excited." Those who shared those moments still speak of the miracle at Cottingham, but the most powerful sense of supernatural forces at work was unleashed at Palamkota, deep in southern India. Graham had read and seen enough of Hindu religion to be aware of its ability to incorporate new beliefs and deities into its fantastically elaborate mythology. Indeed, he was quite aware that Hindus, who could co-opt both Christ and Buddha into their system, were far more likely to attend his meetings than were Muslims, who regarded the Christian doctrine of Jesus' divinity as blasphemy. He also knew of their reverence toward holy men of varied stripe, and had become somewhat accustomed to having villagers gather at the windows of his street-level rooms in primitive hotels to peer wordlessly through tattered curtains at the tall white figure who prayed and read his strange limber book till far into the night. Still, he was not prepared for the response at Palamkota, where the crowd's response to his personal power reached new heights. The evening service did not begin in promising fashion. The huge crowd, estimated at over 100,000 people, had trouble settling down, and a cranky loudspeaker system made it difficult for many people to hear. Some began to shout and scream until the missionaries feared a riot might erupt. Frustrated by the lack of attention, Graham resorted to the one weapon he hoped would work, prayer. "I bowed my head," he wrote, "and prayed a prayer I've not prayed in a long time. It was almost a prayer of commanding, a prayer of authority. I remember I opened my hand as though to come down upon the crowd, and I said, 'Oh God, stop the noise, quiet the people now.' For whatever reason, the power possessed by charismatic leaders manifested itself dramatically. Immediately a death-like hush came on the crowd, and it became the quietest, most reverent meeting we have had in India yet. It was like the breath of God had suddenly fallen. You couldn't hear a sound. Graham preached to the suddenly silent crowd for about an hour, feeling a tremendous power and liberty. Then he recalled, 'Pentecost fell. People began to run forward and fall upon their knees. Some of them began to scream to God for mercy. Others were saying, "Jesus, save me. Jesus, save me," until about 3,000 to 4,000 people had come. And we had to stop the invitation because there was no room for anyone else. They were falling on their knees like flies. It was almost as if they were being slain by the Lord. Inquirers outnumbered trained counselors by at least 10 to 1, so that long after the formal service ended, the meeting ground twinkled with the light of lanterns, whose flames struggled with the darkness, providing just enough light to allow counselors to read from the Bible to the little groups of seekers huddled around them across the hillside. In his room that evening, Graham wrote, "Certainly tonight's demonstration of the Spirit is the deepest and greatest that I've ever sensed. It is almost like something you read about in the ministry of Charles Finney." Word of the evangelist's presence and power spread quickly through the countryside around Palamkota. The next morning, when he arrived at the cathedral to address a meeting of women, he found the sanctuary jammed with 5,000 people. At least an equal number stood outside, clamoring to squeeze inside, and the streets were lined with still others, trying to get at least a glimpse of the man who had created such excitement. As we got to the cathedral, he recalled, the press of the crowd was so great that our car could not get through. The people were pressing and fighting. I almost thought the car would overturn. They were pushing it, grabbing. Many of them were trying to touch us. Jack Dane is fearful that many of the Hindus are beginning to accept me as a god. Many of them fall down and practically worshiped me as I come by. Many of them try to get in my shadow. The looming specter of a jealous deity who does not share his glory filled Graham with a frantic compulsion to disavow whatever illicit thrill the moment may have provided. If seeing his name in lights made him uneasy, seeing himself treated as a god absolutely terrified him. I told them time after time, very much as Peter, that I am not a god, but a man. But the word is spreading all over the southern part of India as to what God is doing, and people are coming for miles to see and hear the revival. Despite denying he had a political agenda, Graham made his customary attempt to forge links with his host country's most powerful and prestigious leaders. He liked to say that the ground is level at the foot of the cross, but the VIP section of the sprawling canvas-covered and neon-lit Shamiana, a kind of flat-topped sideless tabernacle, featured armchairs for ambassadors and embassy staff members while others sat or squatted on the ground. Prominent local government officials had been gracious toward the evangelist in most cities, and in Bombay, the head of Nehru's Congress Party had met him at the airport, informed him that he often quoted him in his speeches, and announced his intention to attend all his meetings in that city. But the real prize was an appointment with Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, who had maintained a polite distance, perhaps waiting to see how Graham would comport himself. As always, Billy had behaved in public in an almost painfully gracious manner, making every effort not to offend any segment of the population, and taking scrupulous care not to utter any public criticism of Hinduism. While privately abhorring much that he saw, in his journal he described the spectacle of priests laying offerings before phallic sculptures in a Benares temple. A scene, he said, made him aware of the powers of darkness and heathenism, more in Benares than in any city in which I have ever been. Graham remained a model guest throughout his tour. Nehru may have appreciated Graham's gentle manliness, but his close identification with America and the Republican administration made the Prime Minister wary. He had accompanied Khrushchev and Bulganin on their tour of the country and had closed schools and government offices in an effort to swell attendance at their appearances. The word in unofficial channels was that it troubled him a bit to see Graham visiting many of the same cities without government sponsorship, yet attracting larger crowds than he and the Soviet leaders had drawn. The Prime Minister agreed to see the evangelist not from any strong personal curiosity, but because Dulles and Richard Nixon, working through Ambassador John Sherman Cooper, had urged him to. Striving to maintain a delicate balancing act of remaining poised between the two superpowers, Nehru evidently felt receiving Graham was a requirement, a testimony to the political clout Billy had acquired. But he made no particular effort to make him feel welcome. Graham knew it would be hard to make a strong impression on Nehru, and his confidence was not increased by the behavior of Dag Hammarskjöld, Secretary General of the United Nations, whose appointment with the Prime Minister immediately preceded his own. As Hammarskjöld crossed the room on his way out, he looked at Graham but did not speak, either not sure that he recognized him or not interested in meeting him. When Graham entered Nehru's office, his host greeted him cordially, but then fell silent, leaving the conversational shuttlecock in the evangelist court. At Dulles's suggestion, Billy spoke of how much Americans admired and respected India and its great leader. Nehru did not respond. Graham volunteered that his tour had given him a much better appreciation for India's problems. Still, no response. Graham later acknowledged his uneasiness, perhaps unconsciously fingering the reason for Nehru's reticence. When I got through what I considered a rather pleasant speech, he didn't say anything. He just sat there with a letter opener in his hand, twiddling it. Then when he began a recital of the high points of his tour, the Prime Minister stared at the ceiling. "I had never had an interview quite like it," Graham recalled. So he fell back on the one topic with which he felt entirely comfortable, regardless of the reaction it stirred. I decided I'd tell him what Christ had done for me, and I told him in no uncertain terms how he had changed me and given me peace and joy, and how he had forgiven my sins. Then immediately he began to be interested. He began to ask some questions. Graham pointed out that he had no interest in preserving Christianity as an outpost remnant of British imperialism. Indeed, he had repeatedly told his audiences that Jesus was an Asian like themselves, with skin a bit lighter than theirs but darker than his own, and had urged them to make their churches indigenous and self-supporting. Nehru warmed to that line of conversation and said he had no objection to Christian missionaries in India as long as they refrained from political activity. He conceded that Graham's presence in India seemed to have a salutary effect, and offered to help in any way he could during his sojourn in New Delhi. Once again, Graham's simple, sincere testimony cut loose from State Department cant, melted a potential opponent's icy reserve, and won for himself, if not a friendship, at least an attitude of tolerant respect. Graham reported that even though Nehru had said nothing, when he ventured that peace would come only when people turned by faith to Christ, he sensed the Prime Minister was pro-Christian. But Billy frequently divined in people, particularly those in positions of power, sentiments that may not have been present. He seemed to assume, in the absence of compelling counter-evidence, that deep down most people saw the world much as he did. His belief in the universality of the deepest human needs and characteristics bespoke a large and admirable spirit, but made it difficult for Graham to accept the brute fact that human cultures and the people they comprise can differ radically over quite basic issues. Throughout most of his public ministry, he had hammered away at the satanic nature of communism, and yet when he met real communists, he found it hard to believe that they understood what they were ostensibly espousing. When he saw Indian communists marching in the street, waving communist flags, shouting communist slogans, and singing communist songs, he walked along beside them and directed his photographer to take pictures. "We marched along about 300 or 400 yards with one group," he reported. "I would wave at them and smile, and they would smile back, because of course most of them, even though they were in red shirts waving the hammer and sickle, did not know what it was all about. I'm convinced that the average communist in India doesn't know what it's all about." The positive side of Graham's attitude was that he believed, and sometimes demonstrated, that open-hearted friendliness could overpower ideology. On hearing of the hospitality and warmth the Indians extended to Khrushchev and Bulganin, and experiencing a similar response himself, he observed that if Eisenhower came to India, he would get the most overwhelming reception of his life, and it would do America a whale of a lot of good. "They don't care two hoots for all the money we give them, but they are thrilled to death when we come in person to visit them." Graham's intuitive grasp of the fact that a symbolic gesture may do more to win a people's allegiance than more substantive measures was accurate. But it led him to make a foreign policy recommendation that must have had diplomats in both capitals groaning. At the airport in Bangalore, he had seen a beautiful plane that Russians had given to Nehru to commemorate their leader's visit. "We give $50 million in economic aid to India," he wrote, and it appears on the third page. Mr. Nehru is given an airplane costing probably $1 million, and it's front page news, and people talk about it everywhere. There's a showmanship in the way the Russians give that puts all of our giving in the shade. I thought, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if we gave to India, perhaps a beautiful new air-conditioned train, or we might give to Mr. Nehru a white air-conditioned Cadillac. This would cause the people of India to talk more than all of our economic aid put together. Before leaving the country, Graham took steps to preserve and extend the achievements of the campaign by making outreach to India an official element of BGEA activities. To do this, he conferred the mantle of leadership he had been weaving upon Dr. Akbar Abdul-Haq, a Methodist scholar who had been his interpreter in New Delhi. A formal and formidable man, Abdul-Haq,